that comes into the rabbinical courts, and that's when there's a transaction, a commercial transaction, and it's a claim of either ona'a or mekachtos. There's a claim that somebody feels that they were cheated, they were defrauded, and therefore they want to rescind or revoke the transaction, or sometimes they just want a price differential. If they want to get, they feel they overpaid and they want some money back. It could also work in the other direction, where the mocher, the seller, feels that he was swindled and got paid too little money for the transaction and really should get paid more money that would be more in accordance with what the merchandise or transaction was really worth. So I wanted to discuss some of the scenarios, and I wanted to really just give a basic outline of the halacha, because there's a lot of confusion and a lot of misunderstanding in this area, and hopefully I won't make everybody more confused and won't create greater misunderstandings. But there are really two fundamental categories. There's the category of ona'a. Ona'a means that somebody was cheated in terms of the price. There's no question about the merchandise. The merchandise is what it was supposed to be. It might be a car, it might be a cabinet, it might be a watch, some piece of a merchandise. It wasn't the wrong type of merchandise, it was the merchandise, but there was a mistake that was made with respect to the price. It was sold for $5, it's really worth $7. It was sold for $7, it's really worth $5. That's what we call ona'a. That's a case where there was a type of cheating that took place with respect to the price. And the first source really that speaks about this prohibition, that one is not allowed to overcharge, and one is not allowed to fool a mocher into undercharging, is a pasuk in Vayikra, Perek Chafei, pasuk Yudalad, Chisim Kalu Mimkar La Misecha, O Kano Miana Misecha, Tonu Ishe Sakiv. When there is a transaction of something which is Kano Miana Misecha, that it passes hands. This is the source of why the Gemara says that the laws of Ona'a don't technically apply to karka, doesn't apply to real estate, because real estate doesn't pass hands. So somebody overcharges with respect to real estate, so the simple understanding is that they probably committed a prohibition, it's not the right thing to do, but there wouldn't be any right to reclaim the difference in price. The Aruch HaShulchan explains that there might be some rationalistic explanation for this as well, because people often are willing to pay an exorbitant price for karka, for real estate, because of location, that sometimes it's difficult to have an objective price when it comes to real estate, that it could wildly vary. So the Torah says, Al tonu ishe sachiv, and that a person is not allowed to oppress their fellow in terms of overcharging, in terms of price fraud, when it comes to a transaction. That's with respect to what we call ona'a. But there's also a secondary concept. Secondary concept is not ona'a, but this is what we call mekachtos. When there is a mistake in the merchandise itself, it is a fraudulent transaction. Not that there's a price overcharging, a cheating in the amount of the price that is charged, but rather that it is a completely mistaken or fraudulent transaction. It doesn't necessarily have to be fraudulent, that somebody was out to trick the other person. It could just be a mistaken transaction. There's a mistake in the inception of the transaction, that you thought you were getting a watch and you ended up getting a pickle. You thought that you were getting a car and you ended up getting a bicycle. Or you thought you were getting a certain type of clothing that was a custom-made suit, and it ended up that this was just some type of a hand-me-down regular suit that came from a Macy's store, Zichronam Levracha, from a couple of generations ago, and it wasn't this customized suit that you had ordered. It was a complete mistake in the transaction, in the merchandise itself, as opposed to in the price. And there are certain differences between whether the violation that's alleged or that is in place is an ona'a violation or whether it's a mekachtos violation. For example, an ona'a violation and generally can only be canceled right away, right after the transaction takes place, when a person has enough time to ascertain that they've overpaid. They have enough time to show the merchandise to an expert, and the expert says, oh, you overpaid by way too much, and then they seek to cancel the transaction. So they would have to do it right away, but if they had enough time to go to an expert and they know that they paid too much, or should have known they paid too much, and they don't complain about it until 6 months later, so they can't undo the transaction at that point in time. As opposed to Mekach Tos, if it turns out that the merchandise that you were given was not the merchandise that you contracted for, that you were supposed to buy, you were supposed to buy a house in livable condition. But it turned out that the house was not in livable condition. It also wouldn't matter whether it was karka or not, because this is not, it's not limited by the limitations of Ona'a. If it's Mekach Tos, so it could be karka, it could be 6 months later, and somebody would still be able to return it. Similarly, in a case of Mekach Tos, even if you know about it, you don't have to necessarily ask for the rescission of the transaction to take place right away. You can wait for a very long time after you know about it, because it's not going to constitute a waiver. There's nothing to waive, since you just didn't receive the merchandise you were supposed to receive. However, if you utilize the object afterwards, so then that would prevent you from saying that it's a fraudulent transaction, because that would indicate that you accepted upon yourself whatever merchandise you had purchased, and then the purchaser would not be able to revoke it afterwards. In the case of Ona'a, the mere fact that somebody utilized the merchandise doesn't take away from their claim. If they are asking for a price differential, for example, they would be able to ask for the price differential. Or if it was a price differential that would enable them to revoke the contract in the case of Ona'a, they could still revoke the contract, but they could just pay for the amount that they have used the object. Different rules, whether we're dealing with Ona'a or whether we're dealing with a Bitul Mekach, or whether we're dealing with Mekach Tos.
And the reason why we're going right to Torah laws, because civil law, Dinei Bachusa, you're saying, doesn't apply?
In general, when we're dealing with transactions, at least when it comes to merchandise between two Jewish parties, we would assume that they intend to be governed by Torah law, unless they say explicitly, or their manner of dealing in general is that which is consistent with the secular law. But Dina de Mahusa does not automatically apply, as we've said in the past, unless it's a highly regulated area where the government is very meticulous that people conduct their transactions in a particular fashion. Now, Dina de Mahusa Dina might apply to Kinyanim, like if the way that I purchase the merchandise from you happens to be a contract, for example, and normally we say metaltalin, the movable property, can't be transferred through a shtar, through a contract, but if Dina de Mahusa would allow it to be transferred in that fashion, so we say that's a form of kinyan. Dina de Mahusa Dina can create additional forms of a binding transaction over and above those forms of binding transaction that would be dictated by the Torah. However, when it comes to whether I am allowed to revoke the transaction, even if the Dina de Malchusa says that I can't, but the Torah law says that I'm allowed to revoke a transaction because I was overcharged, so there's nothing in the Kinyan that limits two parties who are Jewish from conducting that aspect of the transaction according to Torah law. So unless it was implicitly or explicitly stipulated otherwise, of course they would be governed by Torah law. But Moshe Feinstein writes in a tshuva explicitly that when it comes to the binding effect of kinyanim and the ability to revoke kinyanim and the like, so that generally is not subject to the Dina de Malchus Adina, that's subject to Torah law in terms of one's ability to make a grievance or file a grievance after a transaction based on the claim of Ona'a or the claim of Mekach Tos. So I want to just get into the basic rules.
What about if the, whatever the terminology, the practice, the business minhag or practice?
If you have a minhag or something.
For the time frames of when you can return something.
Yeah. Oh. Well, if there's a minhag ha'sokhem in a particular industry that everybody follows and you buy something within that industry, then you could make an argument that you would subject yourself to the limitations of the minhag ha'sokhem. But here we're talking about there's a person who owns a store. He owns a store in the Jewish neighborhood. This is a Sfarim store, and he's selling merchandise. I'm selling a Sefer Torah, and somebody buys it. So these are not things where there would be a minhag ha'sokhem that's going to be different from Torah law. I sell you some schach. and I tell you that this is kosher schach and that it's been certified by the CRC. And then you discover this year the CRC didn't certify the schach, that it was a mistaken representation. So you want your money back. So these are all claims that would be governed according to Torah law. So the Gemara in Bava Metzia Daf Tanun Amud Beis quotes Rava as having basically three different applications of the halacha of Ona'a. There were three different scenarios. That it could be that there was an item of merchandise that was sold, and it was sold for a high price, too high price, too low a price. If the price error or the price differential was less than 1/6, pachas mishtus, nikna mekach. So then it's considered to be a binding transaction. Why is it considered to be a binding transaction? We'll see in a second. If it's yoser al shtus bitol mekach. So there is a concept within the world of Onah that sounds a little bit like mekach tos, but it's not mekach tos. It's not a mistaken transaction. It's bitol mekach. That the person who is defrauded has the right to nullify the sale if he was cheated by more than 1/6. Okay, that there was an item that really is worth $60 and I was charged $71 for the item. If it was an item worth $60, let's say it was worth $70, and I'm the seller and I charged you $60 for the item, this is an example the Aruch HaShulchan gives, you can have 1/6 measured in terms of the money paid or in terms of the value of the item. That's what we call shtus b'mekach or shtus b'mos. It could be measured 1/6 in terms of the money or 1/6 in terms of the value of the merchandise. So if it was an item that was worth $70 and I, the seller, mistakenly only charged you $60 for the item, now I'm the one who ended up being cheated. So this, you can argue that in terms of the money, it's only it's a 1/6 mistake, because the money that was paid was $60, and one sixth of $60 is $10. And the item was really worth $70, so it's a 1/6 mistake. Or it could be a 1/6 mistake in terms of the value of the merchandise. Let's say the merchandise, shtus b'mekach, the merchandise is worth $60, and I mistakenly charge you only $50, right? So in terms of the merchandise is worth $60. So 1/6 of the merchandise is $10. So the $50 that I charge, that's a 1/6 error. So if the error is 1/6, it could obviously go in the other direction. A $50 merchandise in which one person charged $60, etc., etc. But if the error is only of a 1/6 nature, so then we say that the person who was cheated does not have the right to nullify the sale, but they do have a right for the differential in price to be paid back. If it's less than 1/6, so you don't even get the price differential back. It's just the transaction stands. But if it's a 1/6 error, so then you can recover the difference in price. But if the error was more than 1/6, as I said, a $60 item that was sold for $71, the mistake was more than a 1/6. So in such a case, we would say that the person who was cheated has the right to do bitul mekach, has the right to nullify the transaction entirely. But the time that the person can nullify the transaction, if it's the purchaser who was cheated, so then it depends on being able to have enough time to show the piece of merchandise to an expert in the field, and for that expert to say, oh, you paid too much, and here's what it is really worth. So take a look. If it's exactly a shtus kano maxo na, then it's considered to be a binding transaction, but just the price differential has to be returned. But in any of these cases, either it's a sixth or it's more than a sixth, it's the time that the lokeach can revoke the transaction is only within the time that he has the ability to, or can reasonably be expected to find somebody who would be an expert who could assess the item. But if the individual waits longer than that, the lokeach waits longer than that, he can no longer revoke the transaction. You say the mocher has a longer period of time to revoke the transaction because he no longer is holding the merchandise in his hand, so he can't really show it to people. So it might depend on whether there's similar type merchandise and how much time would it take him to come across similar type merchandise. It's a different time frame with respect to the mocher. So the Rosh, in source number 3, asks the question whether if the price differential is less than 1/6, and we say the transaction stands and there's not even a refund of the money, does that mean that a person has the right to charge less than a 1/6 margin of what the item normally sells for? We don't mean to say that when you sell an item, that if you're a seller, you own a store, you're not allowed to make any profit. That's not what it means. It means, of course, every person who sells the item is going to make profit over and above whatever their cost for the item was. But even when you take into account the cost, there's still a market. There's still a market price for the item for which it is typically sold, which takes into account the need for the merchant, obviously, to make a profit. So when we speak about a person overcharging, we mean overcharging beyond that which would be the normal market price for the object to be sold. So the Rashi asks the question, do you have a right to sell within the 1/6 differential in terms of the market price, since that amount would not need to be returned? So the Rashi says it could be that the reason why we don't care, and we say this like a mechila, an implied waiver, if the overcharge or the undercharge is within 1/6, is because Hash Lefi, look at the third line of the Rosh. Okay, this is Perek Dalet Siman Chaf above a Metzia. Borrow four words from the end of the line. Because they can't get it exactly right. You can't get it exactly right. So therefore, it's understood that there is a little bit of wiggle room when it comes to setting the price, because it's very difficult to come up with exactly the right price, at least within a 1/6 margin. However, says the Rosh, according to that explanation, if that is the explanation, then if the mocher really was bucky, he really knew exactly what the price ought to be. It could be mitzam simit. The mocher, the seller, knows that when you sell this brand of ice cream or whatever, it's supposed to be $3.99, and he's purposely pushing up the price to $4.20 to make even more of a profit, because he knows that it's within the 1/6 margin of error. So then we say that even though the sale is going to stand at the end of the day, nonetheless, al ya'anuzet, same lo shi'apare, she has committed an isser, it's still transgression to sell the item for more than the standard price, unless the seller tells the purchaser, you know, if you go to Walmart, you go to one of these other places, you'll be able to get it for less. I happen to charge more money for it. If you want to pay me anyway, go ahead. But if he discloses, so that's a rule when it comes to onar in general. Onar can be waived when there is full disclosure, but the disclosure has to be very precise disclosure. It can't just be, you know that I'm cheating you. You know that I'm overcharging you. You know that I'm charging you more than the standard price, and the buyer says, yeah, that's fine, I want to pay you anyway. That's not good enough. The seller has to say, standard price is $3.99, and you should know that I'm selling it for $4.20. You can even do it if it's more than a sixth. It can say, standard price is $3.99, I'm selling it to you for $5.30. Is that okay with you? And the lokeach says, yeah, that's okay with you. Thank you for letting me know. That's perfectly okay, as long as there is full disclosure. That's what the Gemara says, full disclosure, you can get away with it. It's not like ribbis, in which we say that it's a ritual prohibition that can't be waived by the parties. Onar is a monetary prohibition, but we say that anybody can agree to pay any amount of money that you want. I can agree to give you $1 million, even though there may be no consideration whatsoever, and that's a binding obligation. Parties can agree to do that vis-a-vis each other. That's not considered to be violating a ritual prohibition, as long as it's done with everybody's eyes open. Yes?
If the establishment is nicer than Walmart, okay, has more equipment, you know, better seating, better atmosphere, does he still have to reveal that his price is higher than Walmart?
So we're going to get to that in just a moment. That's the Aruch HaShulchan, okay? So we're going to get to that in just a moment. So the Rosh says that if this is the reason that 1/6 is automatically forgiven because of the fact that people can't calculate the price in exact terms, so then he says, if the mocher knows that he can calculate in exact terms, and he knows what the terms are, and the lokeach is at a disadvantage because the lokeach knows less, so then it would at least be a prohibition. But he says there might be a second explanation. That's the Oshema, four lines from the bottom of the Rosh, five words before the end of the line. Oshema kivin de derech mekach umemkach b'kach. He says, no, maybe even if the mocher knows that he is overcharging for whatever the standard amount is, since sometimes, lefamim lokeach hafes mekach zeh, sometimes a purchaser wants an item so badly that they're willing to pay extra, so therefore the local mocher doesn't have to disclose anything. And most people love damiyotim mekdei shibyo. Sometimes, have you ever wanted an item very badly? Let's say you want a kanfeyona really, really badly, okay? You're willing to pay $100 for it because, you know, to you it's worth it. So if that's so since the mocher knows that that's a possibility, and sometimes it's even the other way around, that a mocher has a fire sale and he's willing to sell items at a dirt cheap price, which is less than the value, so neither one necessarily has to say anything when they're underpaying or when they're overcharging, and that's all included within the Domain Mekach. As long as it's within this 1/6 margin, it's considered within the normal margin of the price. Ve'en kan shem onah klal, therefore it's not considered to be onah at all. It wouldn't even be a violation. So he says, Sarachian, and he concludes, V'yari shemayim yitzei de kulam. But if you're God-fearing, you should be worried that if you're the seller and you know that you're overcharging when it's less than a sixth, you should really disclose it to the buyer just to be on the safe side. So the Aruch HaShulchan, quoting this Rosh, the Aruch HaShulchan, this is Siman Reish Kav Zayin in Choshen Mishpah, Sib Zayin. So the Aruch HaShulchan says, you know what, the suffix that the Rosh says, he says two things, one the chuvah, one which is stringent, and one the kula, one which is lenient. He says, Gam Misfeko, even in his doubt that the Rosh has, as to whether the 1/6 less than 1/6 dispensation is based on not being able to perfectly calculate the price, or whether it's based on the fact that sometimes people are willing for their own personal purposes to undercharge or to overpay. Even according to the second possibility raised by the Rosh, that perhaps the mocher can be even more free in terms of charging an amount which is within the 1/6 margin, because perhaps the lokeach will be willing to pay extra for this item. So he says that's only if that's a possible argument. But if the mokim knows that the lokeach is basically a sucker, that the lokeach is somebody who just is a rube, doesn't know any better, and the mokim is the only one who knows that he's charging an extra pruta, even if it's only an extra pruta, so then even the Rosh would agree that even according to the second side of the Rosh, it would be prohibited for a mocher to take advantage of a very gullible, innocent, unsuspecting buyer. But he says there's also, and this goes to your point, Mr. Fried, there's also a possible lenient application of the Rosh. O nearly davar echad midvar of lakula b'minei sechoros she'enko bali konios mokun osam b'shabe. If I have a type of merchandise where it's known that if you buy it at Walmart, it's going to be one price, and if you buy it in a boutique type of store, it's going to be a much higher price. So then he says that it would not be onah, even according to either side of the Rosh, that it's the type of merchandise where we know that sometimes people make a huge profit and sometimes they make no profit. Ain't shaya klal onah. So then there would not be any type of concern regarding onah, even if a person charges a lot. Kiman shederach hamischar kein hu. Because this is the nature of this type of merchandise, that it really just depends on the setting of where it is sold. There are water bottles. You buy the water bottles in a baseball stadium, so you know it's going to cost a lot of money. You buy a water bottle in a Walmart, so you know it's going to cost practically nothing. So it's the type of merchandise that might depend on the setting. Some will charge a lot and some will charge a little bit. So then it's more difficult to argue that there's ever a problem of onah if you don't have set prices. That's why a lot of the posts can say that nowadays onah really is much more difficult to argue in a Bez than in a Din Torah, because most of the items that are sold have widely fluctuating prices based on where they happen to be sold and based on who the seller happens to be, and based on market conditions, there's a tremendous fluctuation of price. But they point out that there are limits, meaning that even if there's a tremendous fluctuation, generally there's a price at which nobody sells it higher than this particular price, and there's a price in which nobody sells it lower than this particular price. So you could say that anything within that range, from the lowest of what people sell the merchandise for, or the highest price which people sell the merchandise for, maybe nobody can really claim onah within that range. But once you go outside of that range, you go outside of the floor or the ceiling of what the lowest amount or the highest amount respectively may be, so then you can have a claim of onah. But at least the Aruch HaShulchan is telling us that within that range, if you do have a very, very broad range, it'll be much more difficult to claim onah within that range. Source Hay is where the Shulchan Aruch says this very important principle that onah, you do have the right to say to somebody, I'm overcharging you, and this transaction is going to be valid. I'm Menashe Ein Lach Alai Onah. on condition that you don't have a claim of onah on me. So the Shulchan Aruch says, and this is based on the Gemara and Baba Metzia, this is the Psak of Shmuel, you're allowed to do this provided that you're very, very precise about the exact amount of onah. Otherwise, a person may not know exactly how much they are being cheated or overcharged, and therefore it's not an informed waiver. It has to be an informed waiver. Reminds me of a court decision about a Beis Din case that once took place in New York. There was a Beis Din case between two brothers. It was like a zapla. They put together a Beis Din of three rabbis. So the rabbi who had been chosen by, you know, one of the brothers happened to have a close relationship with that brother, a financial relationship, because that brother contributed a lot of money to that rabbi's yeshiva. So as a matter of disclosure, you know, if you have a judge who has a financial connection to one of the parties, then that might jeopardize the validity of the proceedings. So there was a disclosure that the rabbi and the person who chose that rabbi both disclosed that he had donated sums, even significant sums, to the yeshiva. And they asked the other, to the yeshiva of that rabbi, and they asked the other party whether the other party was comfortable with that, and the other party said, yeah, there was a disclosure, and, you know, I'll live with it. But after the Beis Din rendered his decision, and the brother who had chosen this rabbi felt that he had won the case and he wanted to enforce the decision in court, the court refused to enforce the decision of this Beis Din because of the financial relationship between this party and the rabbi he had selected to sit as his borer on the case. So the brother who wanted to enforce the decision argued in front of the court saying, but I made a disclosure. There was a disclosure, and the rabbi disclosed that I have a relationship with him and that I have contributed substantial sums. So the court said, that's not good enough. You needed to say exactly how much was contributed. And if there isn't a very precise disclosure, so the person might not realize what they're waiving. They might think, oh, it's $10,000 when really it's $1 million. And therefore, it might be an insufficient disclosure, and it might not be an informed waiver under those circumstances. So this is a similar principle here as well, that it has to be an informed waiver when there's a condition regarding onah. We can't simply make a condition, you agree that it's okay if I overcharge you. No, that's not good enough. You have to know exactly by how much I am overcharging you in order for that to be an effective waiver when it comes to onah. So let's move on to a source above. We pointed out that when it comes to karka, when it comes to real estate, there's no onah, but as I pointed out, even though onah includes this category of bitul mekach, of being able to rescind the transaction if the overcharging or undercharging is more than 1/6, that's still not the same thing as mekach tos. That's still in the domain of onah, because we're talking about where the merchandise, as the case may be, whether it's metaklin, whether it's karka, that we're talking about is the merchandise that was supposed to be sold. The only problem is that the amount charged was the wrong amount to be charged. It's still in a different domain from mekach tos, of rescinding a transaction because the merchandise itself was defective.
Did you say Eino Noba Karkos was a Xeris Akasuv?
That's Xeris, it's
a rational thing.
No, it's Xeris Akasuv that the Aruch HaShulchan explains can also be be elucidated on a rational basis. That was what the Aruch HaShulchan said. It's Xeris Akasuv. He said, even though it's Xeris Akasuv, I'm going to give you a rational basis for this Xeris Akasuv because of the fact that, you know, Karka has, you know, arguably a greater, you know, value than the set market price, because it's something that can never be lost, it can never be moved away, it's always set in place, it's something you can count on, it's something that location means, you know, a lot to, you know, to people, more than what the market price may be, and, you know, he gives different explanations. So now let's move to the domain of mekach tos, okay? So mekach tos is what? If you, first of all, even within the range of onah, when we speak about how within a 1/6 differential, you do not rescind the transaction or get your money back, so the Shulchan Aruch points out that's only with respect to if there is a mistake in the price that is paid. But if you were supposed to give a certain amount of merchandise where, for example, it's supposed to be 100 items, like 100 nuts, and it ends up being 101 nuts or 99 nuts, So again, here we're making the transition from the price to the merchandise. So here it's a problem with the merchandise. You're supposed to give 100 and it ended up being 99. You don't have the Rush's argument, though. It's that you can't be mitzamtzim exactly what something is worth. I can't be mitzamtzim. I can count the number of nuts. I know it's supposed to be 100 nuts and it's 99 nuts. So you know what happens to that transaction? Even though it's less than a 1/6 error, if you were supposed to give me 100 nuts, you only gave me 99 nuts, you got to give me that extra nut. And if you gave me 101 nuts, unless it's like a baker's dozen or, you know, a nut maker's, you know, 100 or whatever the expression would be, then you have to return that extra one nut, all right? Because that's not onah, he says, that is tos. We're moving from the domain of onah to tos. And tos, a mistake, is a totally different domain, and that's what brings us to Sifches, okay? Source Ches, which is Simon Reish Lamed Beis Sif Gimel in the Shulchan Aruch. Let's say that you sell, it doesn't have to, as I said, if it's mekaktos, it can even be karko. You sell land, or you sell an animal, you sell merchandise, you sell a watch, and it turns out that the mekak has a mum. It has a blemish, okay? It has a major blemish in the object itself. We'll see if the blemish is not intrinsic to the object, it's just sort of an extrinsic side thing, so that doesn't cancel the transaction. That might simply be a differential in, you know, what the transaction was worth, and we're back in onah territory. But if it is a blemish in the object itself, so then the entire transaction can be canceled, and it doesn't have to be done immediately within the time in which the person would be able to discover the defect. No. If it's defective, so then the transaction can be rescinded even 10 years later. This is simply a fraudulent, mistaken transaction. But there's one critical condition, and this is a condition, as I said, with respect to mekaktos, that has no bearing on onah whatsoever, which is that there could be an acceptance of the defect if the person uses the item. That shows that he's happy with the item. So it turned out to be a different item, a blemished item. But if I use the item, and I knew about the blemish when I used the item, so then I'm accepting it. You're raising your eyebrows because he's saying maybe he didn't know. But that's what Shulchan Aruch says. No, this is only he knew about the blemish, and instead of returning the blemish, the Lokach decided to use the object anyway. So then that is considered to be an acceptance of the defect, and the transaction can no longer be abrogated. That's a mechila, it's a waiver, and it cannot be returned. Now, the Aruch HaShulchan gives two exceptions to this rule. One exception is, let's say it's an emergency. I discovered that the car was defective, but I'm in the middle of the road. If I'm going to abandon the car in the middle of the road, I'll be standing in the highway for a bunch of days, and I'll be putting myself in danger. So if I discover the defect in the middle of the road, I can still drive it home. Okay, that's what we call an emergency situation. Secondly, another exception is, let's say that I notified the seller that this car has a defect. What you sold to me has a defect, I want to rescind the transaction. So I know the seller already knows I want to rescind the transaction. It's clear I didn't waive it. So then even if I use the car while I'm waiting for the seller to take my money to return my money and to take the car back, that's not considered to be a waiver of my claim because I've already registered the claim with the seller. So therefore it's clear that I did not engage in a mechila, in a waiver of my claim. Okay? Where is this idea from of a bito mekach? Where do we get it from that you have the ability to rescind the transaction? Oh, no, I understand. It's losono isha samiso. We have a gzera sakasu. It's very interesting. It probably is an extension of this idea that if there's onah, that there is a cheating in transaction. So obviously if the merchandise is defective, I have the ability to rescind the transaction, but it's not necessarily quite as clear in terms of there being a pasuk that talks about mekaktos. There's a sugya in the Gemara in Ksuvos that talks about if I marry a woman, and you discover that she has major blemishes, okay? You don't necessarily know until after you're married, you discover, you know, what the woman is all about. And, you know, there's a certain amount that everybody accepts in a spouse because human beings are human beings. But you discover this is like such a giant blemish. And we talk about what the blemishes might be. person doesn't have, you know, the standard parts of a female anatomy to enable for a normal marital relationship, things of that sort. And the Mishnayos talk about that if it was something which the husband could not have known about, let's say that it was between the Erisin and the Nisuin. He already betrothed the woman, and now after the Nisuin, he discovers major blemishes that he did not accept, he did not agree upon. So that's considered to be a mekach ta'os, and he has the right to divorce the woman and not give her a ksuba. That's basically the upshot of what the mum would result in. So the Gemara then goes on. I'm sorry?
Is that a divorce or an annulment?
No, it's a divorce. He has to give her a get. He has to give her a get. The pashtus of the sugya is he has to give her a get. There are certain cases where we might say even a get isn't necessary, but let's talk with, that's not the topic for tonight's shiur. So the simple reading of the Gemara is he gives her a get, but he's not obligated to pay her a ksuba. But the Gemara then talks when in discussion of the types of this fraudulent transaction, a mistaken transaction in the context of marriage, compares it to a person who buys a donkey, buys an animal, and it turns out there's a major blemish with the donkey, the animal, and so forth. So the Vilna Gaon on this siman in the Shulchan Aruch that talks about annulling a transaction says, where do we find this idea of bitul mekach? He says, lamad mechira meisha, that the main sugya is marriage. This is all about, it starts off with marriage. The whole idea of bitul mekach comes from a mistaken marriage of where there is some type of a mistake in the entering into of the marriage, a marriage which is based on mistaken pretenses, and it is from that model, that case which is discussed in the Gemara Ksuvos of how you can sometimes annul or at least divorce a woman without paying a ksuba, a marriage based on when it was entered into, based on mistaken pretenses. That is the source for the whole sugya, says the Gra, a bitul mekach when it comes to Choshen Mishpat.
So if there is no pasuk for this, is this a drabbanan inyan?
No.
In other words, is the whole bitul mekach only midrabbanan? You're marrying a woman, adas the chachomim, but minat Torah, there is no bitul mekach issue.
Let's hold that question. It's a good question.
Meaning the same that problem with the shtus. Is the other thing with Ona, is the amount of shtus. What if, does somebody say, no, not
for
a
the
six,
shtus,
it's
you
a
could
quarter.
Say, for the shtus, you could say, l'masvan akastu l'chachamim, that we know that there's an idea of Ona, which is mentioned in the Torah. The chachamim define the parameters of Ona. I would understand this as well as being some sort of an expanded application of the idea of Ona, but I'm just quoting the Vilna Gaon. How would you understand it according to the Vilna Gaon? You ask a very good question. So I don't have an answer to that question offhand, other than to say, let's put that to the side, and we'll get back to it when we have a chance to explore it a little bit more rigorously. Now, the Sma on this comment of the Shulchan Aruch that says that if it, the object was utilized, he says, "Hu adinim ayadav shelokeach yakol avkinah li'altar." If it was, let's say that the lokeach did not utilize the object, but the lokeach could have noticed that there was some defect in the object, but he bought the object anyway. So do we say that's the equivalent to using the object? So he quotes the Magen Mishnah, who says that in such a case, if the lokeach could have had an opportunity to test the car before he bought the car, and he would have noticed that it had this major defect, whatever it is, that the engine doesn't work properly, whatever the defect is, he would have been able to pick it up. So that also is considered to be a sufficient waiver. The Mishnah Lamech disagrees. Mishnah Lamech says that if you look at the Lashon of the Rama, which the Shulchan Aruch is based upon, which says, so he says that mashma da filu ra'am u'mishasa kozer. It sounds like the only thing that would prevent the lokeach from rescinding the transaction, if it turns out to have a major defect, would be if he actually used it after he discovered the defect. But not if he was rav shasak, if he noticed the defect and just didn't say anything, says that if that was the case, then the Rambam would have formulated the halacha differently. So the Maisa, it's a major machlokis between poskim as to whether this would be grounds for the seller to say, you should have noticed that there was a defect and you can't therefore cancel the transaction afterwards. So we had a case where there was a woman, look at case number one. Go back to page one, case number one. A woman ordered a set of customized chairs to match her dining room chairs and was sent pictures to view the final product. She looked at the pictures closely, she would have seen that they didn't match her dining room chairs 100%. When they arrived, she discovered that there were slight differences in design. Is she entitled to receive her money back? She hadn't used the chairs yet. It happens in this particular case. She contacted the seller and said, I don't think it matches the design 100%. And after she registered the claim, then she had like a major Sheva Brachos meal or something that she was hosting, and she needed all of her chairs. So she used the chairs, so she had two arguments in her favor that this should not revoke her claim. Number one, that it was an emergency situation. And number two, she had already registered that she wanted to rescind the transaction. So therefore, she didn't lose on that basis. But the question was, should she lose that on her claim on the basis of the fact that she had actually been sent pictures to view the final product? And had she looked at the pictures, she would have noticed that they didn't match the chairs 100%. There's another consideration as well, which is that the differences were arguably very, very slight. So the question is, if the differences were very slight, is that really grounds to say that this is a sufficient reason to nullify the transaction? If you take a look, let's turn back to source Yud Gimel. So source Yud Gimel says, Makar lo basa, the Ramah has, this is in Siman Reish Alam Gimel, the Ramah says that let's say somebody buys meat, and the meat is presented as a very special kind of meat, like a very dainty kind of meat, which is an ayel misuras, that it comes from a ram that is castrated. And as we all know, if you're going to be eating the meat of a castrated ram, that's going to be like really, really tasty, right? But it turns out that it was not really a castrated ram after all. So says the Ramah, that's so extrinsic to the main part of the transaction, which is just having good meat. You have good kosher meat. Who cares whether it was a castrated ram or not? I mean, I don't know. Is there anything that you've ever insisted upon? I personally don't. When I ask for my meat, I don't even like look, you know, in the labels to see whether it was castrated. So we say that no, if there's a difference in the price, you get the price back, but it's not considered to be a defect in the merchandise per se, that you would be entitled to your money back. Eliam Kane, Yadua Shalokeach Istinus. Unless you know that this purchaser is one who is very, very picky and delicate about where their meat comes from, and they say they want Ayom Misuras, it's very, very meaningful to them. So if in this particular case, the seller of the furniture knew already, and we determined probably had good reason to know that this purchaser was a very particular person in terms of what they wanted, so even a slight defect therefore could have constituted a defect in this case. Another interesting comment that the Nesivus makes, this is a source Yud Dalet Siman Reish Git Lamed Gimel Sif Katan Gimel on this very sif in the Shulchan Aruch. He says Lashita Samama Hu Adin LeKol Davar Shinira LeBezin Shein Kepay DeKolkach. Says ultimately this is a decision we often say about different areas of halacha in Ladayel LeMasha Ina Boaz. This is a decision that Bez Din has to use its discretion about how much a particular blemish really ruined an item or really was intrinsic to the definition of the item that we would say that this is defective merchandise. How much is it something like Ayo Masuras, which really is not important unless the Bez Din determines that this individual was very particular and the seller should have known that this individual was an Istinus who is very, very particular? And to what degree do we say that, whatever the defect was, maybe it wasn't a big deal? So in this case, we determined that even though, you know, with customized furniture, it happens to be particularly difficult to get it to match 100% customized furniture that was produced a couple of years ago, if it's not all made at the same time, we determined that, yeah, it made sense that the Mokas should have known that the Lokeach was very particular. On the other hand, the Lokeach had a chance to look at the merchandise before they paid for it. So the question was, under these circumstances, who should win the case? And we ruled ultimately based on the Mishpat Shalom, I think of the Marsham, says that we draw the following distinction. We say, it's a machlokas haposkim. whether the person who is the purchaser can revoke, can cancel the transaction when they had a chance to check out the merchandise. And here it was like very specifically showed them, here's the merchandise, you know, you could check out the merchandise, and they didn't notice. Now you could say maybe it would have required a little bit of extra effort on their part to have looked at the pictures closely enough to notice that the designs were not exactly perfect, and that's part of what the machlokes is all about. The Mishpat Shalom says, well, it depends whether the money has been paid yet or not. So he says that if the money has not yet been paid, so then we can follow the opinion, we follow the Muktzah, and we follow the opinion of the Mishnah Lamelech, right, who says that that the person still has the right to back out from the transaction, and therefore we're not going to force them to pay the money. But if the money was already paid, so then we follow the opinion of the Magid Mishnah that says that, well, really the person, the lokeach, the purchaser, should have noticed the blemish when they got the pictures, and therefore they would not get their money back. So in this particular case, the money had already been paid, and we said, therefore, they should not get the money back. But as a matter of pshara, we said, make a 10% discount, you know, for the amount, just so everybody should get along, and also because of the fact that in this case, the mocher knew that the lokeach, the seller, knew that the purchaser was a very, very particular person, so therefore maybe they should have, lifnim mishur sadin, gone out of their way to really identify or really remind them that they should look very, very clearly and carefully at the pictures just to make sure that it satisfied all of their specifications before shipping the furniture. But that's how we dealt with that particular case. Now if we go further, in Sif Tes above, okay, the Arach HaShulchan talks about the general principle of how do we know if this is considered to be a blemish or not for purposes of saying that a transaction is a mekaktos. You know, it's interesting, I had a Sefer Torah case. When I was at the Beis Din of America, somebody ordered from a sofer Sefer Torah, and then they claimed after they received the Sefer Torah that the letters weren't written properly, that people told them it wasn't really kosher. They wanted to return this. The way mekaktos works is that you return the merchandise and you get them your money back. They wanted to return the Sefer Torah and get the money back.
You don't hold out to the mashkon until you get
your money back? Well, the way that it would be, that it would take place is that the parties agree. They agree. In other words, the person who was cheated or the person who got the defective merchandise can't say, I want to keep the defective merchandise and I want my money back. They have to return the defective merchandise. And the person who's being requested to give the money can also say, I don't want to give you the money unless you give me back the merchandise. But the real question here was, in this case, the person who wrote the Sefer Torah felt that they did a good job and that they should be entitled to keep the money. So we actually hired a crackerjack, you know, world-class sofer to come and to examine the Sefer, and it was very, very fascinating. You really couldn't do this in civil court so easily. And the Sefer Torah was very, very carefully examined by the sofer, and then it was kind of interesting while sitting around as the dayanim. And after the sofer checked the sefer, so one of the dayanim, he was a very big Talmid Chacham, he's no longer alive, very, very fine rav, so he turned to the sofer and like started asking about his sister and the family and so forth. So the other dayan and I like looked at him and said, what's going on over here? Like, you know, this guy, we had it, you know, it turned out that the sofer was the brother-in-law of one of the dayanim. So that required a disclosure issue. So we made sure to disclose to the parties, not that it necessarily would impact other cases, but we did disclose to the parties that the sofer happened to be the brother-in-law of one of the dayanim. We just had no idea that was the case. But the sofer basically concluded that the Sefer Torah that was written in perhaps a slightly unusual fashion in terms of the ksav, but it was 100% kosher and everything was perfectly fine, and you know, reassured us that there was no, you know, mekaktos here in this particular transaction. But you know, these cases do come up from time to time. Like, let's say that there's a letter that's written a little bit in an unusual fashion. Is that what constitutes mekaktos? So the standard that's given by the Arach HaShulchan, take a look in source test, Simeresh Lamed Beis Siv Zayin, is as follows. It would have to be an agreement of the people from the country or from that community that this is considered to be a blemish for this type of merchandise. Again, if it's, you know, a sophisticated type of merchandise, so then you bring in the experts. You bring in the experts to ascertain whether this is really considered to be a blemish or not. But if the general assessment of those in the know, okay, whether it's your average purchaser, you know, this is like a type of item that everybody knows about, like a Price is Right type of item where everybody can say, oh, this is worth, you know, they can guess how much it's worth. Or if it's a sophisticated item, the experts would say that it's not a mum. It would only have a din of onah, meaning we don't do away with din of onah. If we say that, oh, maybe it's not like a mum that's considered to be so intrinsic to the very definition and identity of the object that it would be a mech of tos, but maybe there are slight defects. It's just that it doesn't rise to the level of a major defect in the merchandise. If there are slight defects, so then it might turn out after the fact that the person paid too much money because there was a slight defect, and therefore in this particular case, maybe they should have paid less. They did get the item, but because the item had a slight defect, it's not a mech of tos, but it would put it back in onah territory that we would say, so then maybe the price differential should be returned in this particular case. Elim came pirish b'shas akniya, or if the price differential is such, like there were so many defects that the amount that was paid was more than 1/6 of the value, so maybe then the person would have the right to nullify the transaction, but not based on the argument of mekach tos, but based on the argument of bitul mekach. And then if it's karka, they wouldn't be able to do that, for example. Though some say with karka, if it's more, the price that was charged was more than 100, was more than twice the objective appraised value, so then there'd be onah with karkos. But you would have to follow the different rules. Whatever the rules are in onah, you would have to follow those rules, okay? Elim came pirish b'shas kniyah shalayim sadova kazeh, unless, whenever the seller says to the purchaser says, it's really important to me that the ksav, you know, be ksav beis Yosef, or that, you know, or that this merchandise, that the design of the chairs be exactly this crisscross, you know, in this formation, and that is spelled out, and the seller says that I guarantee you that I am going to do precisely that, so then it becomes an extremely intrinsic, important, essential part of the merchandise once that request has been registered by the purchaser. But if the request hasn't been registered and the seller hasn't made the commitment, so then we just follow whatever is the normative understanding of what constitutes a serious defect and what does not constitute a serious defect. Now let's say that there's a defect, somebody buys 20 of something. They buy like 20 shares and there's a defect in only one share. So that one share has a major defect. Can the purchaser in that circumstance say, well, I want to rescind the transaction for all 20 shares, okay? Or, you know, it's some other type of merchandise where it's a set and there's only one part of the set which is defective. So generally speaking, we say that if each one is able to stand alone, then if one of them is defective, the purchaser doesn't have a right to cancel the rest. However, the Sefer Pesachei Koshin makes the following comment in Source Tet Zayin. Let's take a look at the comment. It says like this: Upashut aliba tekuliyama shekone davar morkav mikama chalakim. If you do buy something which is a composite object, okay, or it is a composite product where each part depends upon all of the other parts, shebiyachem mehavim davar shalim, it's only considered to be one part when all of the pieces gel together just so. Kigon marechas kelim, like you have a configuration of utensils that all go together, like a candelabrum, osidra sefarim shedinam kamekach echad, or you have like a set of shas, where it all has to be perfect. So it says if any of them are defective, then it's considered to be like one purchase, and if a person, any of the items are defective, then the purchaser has the right to rescind the transaction. I bought a shas, for example. I bought an entire shas. This happened recently. I had bought a Shulchan Aruch, a set of Shulchan Aruch for Beis Yitzchak, okay, and one of the volumes was turned out to have be upside down. You know, like when you look at the outside part, it says Shulchan Aruch, and you open it up, and all the pages are upside down, okay? So if you have something like that, that's considered to be a blemish with respect to the entirety of the transaction. The Pesachei Koshin says, now if, you know, the store will say, oh, we will give you a replacement for that particular volume, so that's fine. But if they're not prepared to replace that particular volume, so you have the right to say, so I didn't get, you know, I didn't get my Shulchan Aruch, you know, according to specifications, I didn't get my shas properly, so therefore I have the right to return the entire shas to you and to get my money back, unless you're going to correct. If they correct the defect, that's fine. But if you're incapable of correcting the defect, so the entire set is defective. It's not just one volume that's defective. The entire set ends up being defective. So we had a case like this where somebody ordered a window treatment in their home. They ordered a complicated, complex window treatment where the windows would be going practically from floor to ceiling. It was like a room, it was a house where the first floor had very high ceilings, a very grandiose, you know, type of house. And they ordered expensive windows. And when the person who installed the windows installed them, there was one particular window that just didn't fit properly. It didn't fit properly. And there was this big machlokus about why it is that this, and it was, you know, this whole system where you press a button and they all go up, and then you press a button and they all go down, and they're all working together and they all look beautiful as one big set. But this one window was just ruining the entire configuration. So the person who ordered the windows asked the installer to fix it. And the person, you know, tried a little bit, but said, I'm sorry, this just, it's not a problem with the shades that I have bought. It's a problem with your basic window. You had asked for me to provide these very elegant window shades, but there's a problem with the window that you have. Therefore, I'm not going to fix it, and I don't want to take the time that it's going to take to have to adjust the shade in such a way that it's going to fit around your cockamamie window. So the person who ordered the window shades has said, but I ordered them so that you should figure out, because of your expertise, how to make the shades work on my windows, and you shouldn't blame my poor window for the fact that you're not doing a good job with the shades. It's like that classic machlokus in the Gemara about who's guilty when you have like a mouse that grabs a piece of cheese from you and runs into the hole. Is it the fault of the mouse, or is it the fault of the hole? So that's basically what they were arguing about. Was it Akbar Ganav or Chura Ganav? You know, so they had this rip-roaring battle about it. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the person who was installing the shades just said, it's not, you know, my responsibility to try to, you know, make the shade work, you know, around your window that has this problem. So ultimately, the Bezdin said, look, they were paying top money for this person who was an expert in installation to come along and to figure out how to make these shades work. That was their responsibility. If there was one shade that didn't work, so that upset the entire configuration. And therefore, there was a valid taina to say, to the degree that there would be a taina of mekach tos, which we thought was not, you know, unreasonable under the circumstances, to say that if that one window was not fixed, the person shouldn't have to really pay for any of the windows and any of the window shades, and should have the right to, you know, simply return the window shades. This person said, I don't want the window shades anymore. They're not worth anything to me. They were built for this particular home. So it's a very interesting machlokas. There we also made a pshara in that particular case that since part of the purchase price was already paid and part wasn't paid, so he said that the part that was already paid, really there was a claim of mekach tos, but they weren't looking to get back the amount that they paid. They basically were moichel that amount. It's just that, you know, since the person who had installed the window shades wanted to get paid the amount that wasn't paid, so once he wanted to get paid the amount that wasn't paid, they said, well, you want back all the money that we already paid. So he said, we feel that there was already a mechila. That's a whole diyun as to whether if a person wasn't going to make a claim, they only make a claim because it's a din Torah. So chacham tzvi about that. There's a ktos. Technically speaking, we hold that a person can resurrect a claim. We told us Pshara in this particular case, we said, you know, you waived it, but we did not require them to pay the extra money that they hadn't paid yet, because we felt that this really did enter into Mekach Tos territory, because there was a whole Ma'arechus at play, there was a whole system, a whole configuration that depended upon every single window shade being just right.
Did they return all window shades?
What?
They
would have been happy to. He just didn't want the window shades, you know, returned under the circumstances. Yes.
I buy a gold wedding ring for Kedushin, and it turns out to be gold plated. And I find out afterwards when she wants to resize it a couple of years later, according to the Sma, hey, you could have checked it out. You could have taken a magnet and seen if it was copper with plating, or
The Aruch HaShulchan says that all of these different blemishes that we're talking about—that's
a big blemish, gold plated or gold.
So again, says all of these different blemishes that we're talking about are talking about blemishes which are very much galoy. These are blemishes which are the blemishes that are not begaloi. They are not open and notorious and obvious. They are blemishes that are hidden or that are sufficiently inconspicuous that it takes some time to identify that the blemish is there altogether. But he says that if you sell something and say, this is a gold watch, And anybody looking at it can see that it's tin, okay? They can see that it's clearly not gold, so then there's no claim of mekartos for anything which a person can very clearly and visibly see is not exactly the way that it is being represented. So in a case where a person really could have been able, where there's no question, it's not like you have to look hard, like in the pictures of the design of the custom-made chairs to recognize that the design was not exactly consistent with the original design, but you can see that it's not gold, and you're buying it anyway, and you give over the money anyway, so that is viewed as a waiver at the time of the transaction.
But a gold-plated watch looks like gold.
But if it looks like it's gold...
I mean, do I have any obligation to test it out? According to the SMA, I could have taken it to... the Magen Mishnah, I had opportunity to take a magnet and see...
So according to the Magen Mishnah, if you have the opportunity to check something out...
And I didn't,
you didn't check it out, so then you lose your right to really? Register the claim. That's what the Magen Mishnah sounds like, right?
Yeah.
You take a look, the Magen Mishnah says... Now he says... If it's something he could have checked out the altar. So if it's something that would require you to go to an expert, and only an expert would be able to tell you whether it was really gold-plated or not, so then that probably does not even qualify for the Magen Mishnah. But the Magen Mishnah is talking about something where the person without necessarily going to an expert would have been able to check out and figure out on their own without too much difficulty, so that according to the Magen Mishnah, they would lose their right to make the claim. But I don't think that it would necessarily cover your case. I think that in your case, even the Magen Mishnah might agree that you would still have a claim for mekartos for defective merchandise. So in Yetz Hashem, next time around, we covered the first two of the five different scenarios of mekartos cases. So in Yetz Hashem, next time around, we'll cover the remainder of the sources and the last three cases as well. And in Yetz Hashem, remember, we'll be meeting next 2 weeks from today. Next week, we're going to take a break. And I look forward to seeing you then. Okay. Very good. Okay. You're welcome to keep on learning. Yeah, I think so. So in a case where it's covered and you couldn't tell, right. And it doesn't even fall into the Magen Mishnah's territory of the altar that you could figure it out, so then I think there would very clearly be a claim for mekartos. Yeah.
Only in a case where it's on the corner of the market, so therefore there's really no market price.
He's kind of like, he's the monopoly, so the market is whatever he
diamonds,
says the market
the beers,
is.
The beers,
so,
the beers.
Right. So we spoke about that a little bit. So then as long as he's charging within the range of, whatever that market that he's created is, then nobody can claim onah. But if that person goes outside of, because every single market, even if it is a wildly fluctuating one, generally has an outer range. So if the person goes outside of the outer range, because in other words, it would have to be that they would charge anybody this amount. But if somebody walks in and they're just charging this person amount because they don't know any better, then I think that it would be subject to onah, even in that type of circumstance. If the person would just charge anybody who walks in, that's a different story. But if they see, here's somebody who really is unsuspecting, so I'm going to, charge this person $100,000 for a hot dog, because they're like some foreigner and they don't know the difference between $10 and $100,000. So, even if it's somebody who has a monopoly in the market, I think that would still constitute onah.
If the builder sells on 10